Welcome to That's a Dive. I'm Kyle Martino. Tad Potters. Another great weekend of Premier League action. The plot thickens. It's getting good. It's getting good, and it's really early. We're forcing ourselves to have to calm down a bit, you know, and avoid being hyperbolic because there's some craziness going on. I mean, this was a tough week to pick the three topics because there's so much going on in the Premier League. But I got PJ with me, and he helped focus me. He helped me trim it down to three good topics. But before we get into them, we got some reviews. We got some reviews, and I want to read my three favorite. If you're a loyal Tad Pod, you know what I meant. If you're a loyal Tad Pod listener, you know that we do a fun thing with the reviews. The reviews are important. They help the Tad Pod get listened to. They help bump us up on all those things. And you guys have been doing it. And last season, we did a fun one where you did your favorite movie reference. This season, I changed it. I flipped the script. What we're going to do, which is apropos, as there are so many amazing soccer moments going on already in this Premier League season, I wanted you to throw out a review and add your big soccer moment, that moment you really just fell in love and said, this game is the greatest and I need it. And here are three of my favorites. Starting with Sterling Silver 3, one of, if not the brightest commentators in soccer. I think he's talking about PJ. Martino is a killer. First time getting chills was watching Torres score against Barcelona in the UEFA Champions League semifinal. Had followed them since the Joe Cole days, but that was the first time I ever truly lost it. As they said on the broadcast, his transfer was worth every penny after that. That's a great moment. Do you remember? It was Gary Neville, right? Mm-hmm. Gary Neville on the... I mean, Sterling Silver, you were watching the game, so you know it. If you don't remember that game or you haven't watched that goal when Torres scores right at the end as Barcelona are pushing and have all their numbers forward, I think he was onside simply because he was on his own half when the ball was played forward to him, and then it was just 1v1 all the way.
You know what's funny? If you watch it back, he actually tried to make a little move right before that, and he gave the ball away, and then Barcelona tried to play through, and because he made the move, he actually ended up all by himself.
Completely out of position.
And Barcelona, they had to score at that point. We're pushing, and because they ended up giving the ball away, he was just standing there by himself, so he ended up, you know, they got Chelsea won the ball back and played it through, and he's all alone and scored that
goal.
But
the best part of the
was the call,
Gary Neville. Oh, my God. He loses his mind. I don't think I've ever... I mean, it's out there above Ray Hudson's just orgasmic, going nuts, out of control calls, which I love, and I love Ray Hudson, and no one does it better. But Gary Neville on that day lost his mind, completely lost his mind. So just YouTube it. It's classic. Next one, Wonder Boy. This is by RP3M86. My most cherished football memory was Michael Owen's World Cup goal versus Argentina. That was such a sick goal. Mm-hmm.
That whole World Cup was great. But.
Yeah, that game was insane. Mm-hmm. My favorite part of that game was Ariel Ortega megging Paul Ince in the middle of the field. That's just me. But I remember, too, Michael Owen, when he went to go score that goal, I feel like it was like Paul Scholes or someone was right to his right when he got by. I think it was Ayala, and he put it onto his right foot, and I think it was Scholesy. He was telling him to leave it so he could come through and absolutely smash it. If it wasn't Scholes, someone correct me at Kyle Martino on Twitter, but I think it was. And Owen's like, no, I got this. Let me just put it up in the corner against the grain because I'm Wonder Boy, and that's a great moment. Last one. You know, the cool part about some of these moments is the recent ones, which goes to show you, like, it's never too late to jump on. Never too late to get involved in the beautiful game. This one's from Ahmed RVP. Although he can't resist taking a shot at Jose Mourinho. He's absolutely right. Although no shots at Jose Mourinho lately. How could you? Kyle is a very good soccer analyst. I think he should do a podcast about how he maintains his hair. We're working on that. That's coming next season. My favorite moment in soccer is the first time I watched Manchester United. It was the 99 UEFA Champions League final at Camp Nou. That was the Solskjaer goal that won it right at the end. And he said he'll never forget it for the rest of his life. That was insane. That was another, like, kind of like the Torres moment. But wasn't it Teddy Sheringham kind of headed it down to him? Am I remembering that one rightly?
Yeah,
and Solskjaer
right.
Scores right at the end, the super sub, the babyface assassin. That was insane. So thanks for the reviews, Tad Potters. Thanks for listening, and keep the reviews coming. And, don't forget to throw out your first time you fell in love with the beautiful game. Let's get on to the topics, PJ. The three we picked this week, Liverpool, some maybe updates on the Coutinho situation, but the Coutinho situation continues to be a distraction because they just struggle to get the business done in a convincing way on the field so far in their first two games in the Premier League campaign. The next topic, Tottenham, the Wembley woes. Is this a curse? Is this the real deal? Is this voodoo? Is Wembley the bogey ground? We'll dip into that a bit. But first, let's talk Chelsea. Massive result at Wembley for Antonio Conte and his men. Now, leading into this game, not only did they have the negative just distraction and remnants of their opener against Burnley, where many were asking themselves, is this another capitulation? Are they going to fall apart again? Is this just the sophomore slump like we saw with Jose Mourinho? And they answered emphatically, no, we're focused. We're behind this guy. We're going to put a performance out there. And they absolutely did. And that was a very difficult game to win because Spurs, I thought, were excellent. And, you know, Chelsea just set themselves up perfectly to go win that game. A vintage Italian performance in terms of the tactical mind of Antonio Conte. I said it when we saw the lineups, PJ, when they came out an hour before the game. It was going to be like he set up Italy in the Euros. Like, I mean, the classic. I can't remember the phrase. The starts with a C. There's a famous Italian phrase for the way they defended. It'll come to me at some point. But it's a old school Italian counterattacking, defense first, center of the field, overload, close down the passing lanes, catch the team on the counter. And he did it in the Euros with an Italian team that was man for man, personnel-wise, not one of the better ones we've seen in a major tournament from Italy recently. And in that tournament, and I remember the Belgium game was the most impressive one, he did it with Graziano Pella and Eder as the sort of 1-1 at the top of the field to help them counter. In this game, it was Morata and Willian that did that role so well. But the impressive tactical switch we saw from Antonio Conte was throwing David Luiz into the middle, almost playing like a sort of a sweeper of the midfield, sitting there with Bakayoko ahead of him to one side and N'Golo Kante ahead of him to the other side, and throwing the young Dane, Christensen, into his first Premier League start at Wembley against Spurs in the center of a back three, and he was excellent. I mean, the system worked perfectly. The personnel was outstanding. You know, obviously the play of Marcos Alonso, the fullback who gave them two bright moments, was excellent. Bakayoko, not entirely fit, coming back from knee surgery. He played a closed door friendly on Thursday, I think, against QPR. So there's no way he was fit to do what he did. He lasted 90 minutes. He played the entire game and covered a tremendous amount of ground. Obviously, it was a bit raw. He still has to get up to the speed of the Premier League, but what an amazing performance from him. David Luiz, the performance of the day, with how great he played in a role he's played for Chelsea in the past, that he's played for other teams in the past, but hasn't played for a long time. He just slot right in there, protected the back line, closed down passing lanes. He was a deep playmaker, read the game very well. I mean, it was just an excellent performance. Not only coming off of the distraction of a terrible opening game, but coming off of the Diego Costa distraction that continues. And if you haven't listened yet, I've got a Tadpod Mini about it where I go deep into the Diego Costa situation. We were trying to get Robbie Musto on the pod this week so he and I could just go at it because we differ in one crucial area. He thinks Diego Costa is a big baby and this is all his fault. And I give a little bit of the blame to Antonio Conte with how he's handled it. But we look like we're getting past that. I mean, Diego Costa is still doing interviews. The most recent one is that he's never texted Antonio Conte, so it makes it look like Antonio Conte sent that text, which to me is the only thing he's done wrong in this whole situation. The fact that he's willing to get rid of their leading goal scorer over the past 3 years, the guy that helped them to two titles I don't think they would have had without Diego Costa, you know, that's his prerogative. He thinks he's a distraction. He doesn't like what he did in January, kicking up a fuss, trying to force a move to China. You know, Jose Mourinho was more willing to deal with Diego Costa because, by the way, in 2015, right after the first title, he wanted to leave then too, And, you know, he disrespected Jose Mourinho then. He tried to force a move then. But Antonio Conte, chemistry, respect, professionalism is much more important to his team than Jose Mourinho's. And that's not a slight on Jose Mourinho. Who was it? He said, I always take a shot at Jose Mourinho. Was that Silver?
That was Ahmed RVP.
Ahmed. See, Ahmed, I snuck in a shot at Jose Mourinho. I just can't help myself. But I think that situation is going to be handled here really soon. Supposedly, Atletico Madrid's coming in with the right money. They're coming correct, right?
Yep. And one of the latest story, too, is that Costa's recently just had his all of his...
Oh, the movers came.
The movers have been called over to his apartment or his house or whatever.
It's so dramatic. So he's definitely not coming back because the movers moved his 75-inch flat-screen TV. So this performance, PJ, could not have come at a better time. Spurs were excellent at moments, especially the end of the first half, the end of the second half. They asked all sorts of questions. There are certain issues with Spurs on the day, but all in all, I thought it was an excellent Tottenham performance. And it just highlights how good Chelsea were on the day and how good they were in the most important way. Defensively, sitting back without the ball, the hardest thing to do in the game when you have a team full of attacking players that have the talent to play more ambitious, more open, more offensive. They sat back and they obviously are playing for Antonio Conte. That's what that performance said to me, is these guys are behind him. The Diego Costa situation isn't really going to affect this group over the long term. The sophomore slump, I don't think it's going to affect this group as much as, definitely not as much as it did under Jose Mourinho, but not as much as many thought. But I still do think it's a work in progress. I mean, that was him reverting back to, as I said, what he did in the World Cup with Italy, a style that sometimes you use when you need to go back to basics and you might not be confident you have the force yet, the attacking force yet, to be a little more open, to play with one less defensive midfielder, to add a Pedro in there as opposed to a Luis or a Bakayoko. So they're still working on things. This is by no means does this mean they've turned a major corner. I just think it was a big statement that it's not as bad as the fears after the first game.
I mean, would you say this past week with the home loss to Burnley to start the season and the Diego Costa situation resurfacing with the article and just the way that, you know, you mentioned in your last podcast with Conte laughing during the press conference the questions about Costa. Was this his most difficult week as a Chelsea manager?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe after the Arsenal loss last season, which is where they eventually turned it around, mm-hmm. Was pretty difficult too. But so I think just kind of, if it is, just the way that you just mentioned, the way that they responded for him is a huge statement for this team going forward. And I think a big reason why we hopefully won't see that sophomore slump like mm-hmm. we did 2 years ago.
Or the sort of ridiculous knee-jerk pressure on a Chelsea manager that we mm-hmm. always see yep. that's been there since Abramovich has been there. Now, you could criticize that, but it's also come with trophies. I mean, that's been Abramovich's strategy from day one. What have you done for me lately? And the second things go a bit south, he gets a guy out and finds a new guy. So for Antonio Conte, it was big to take that pressure off of him from the big man upstairs. But also, I think what it did is it's great because it took pressure off him, but it also said to the people upstairs, I need some players. You know, after the first game, the criticism might have been more on Antonio Conte because you don't need more players to beat Burnley, who only lost one game or only won one game away from Turf Moor last year. So, like, no disrespect to Burnley. We always say that, right? No disrespect, and then you disrespect them. But they didn't need more players to win that game. That was a bad performance. They were disorganized. They were unmotivated. They didn't bring the requisite intensity and effort to win a game that they should have won at Stamford Bridge. But after Spurs, you say, okay, there it is. Antonio Conte got his guys back organized. That was an excellent tactical execution. Performances individually all across the team, excellent. They're light. We need to add guys. Eden Hazard's coming back. He's training right now, coming back from that ankle injury. Bakayoko played 90 minutes. I would imagine they're going to rest him a little bit after that. He probably can't bounce back right away and play some more games.
Fabregas and Cahill will return.
Yeah, Pedro's going to, he's back
Pedro
from his injury. So they're getting guys back, but I think the message is still pretty clear. We need guys. We need reinforcements. We need to add to this team. Because the other thing they've done is they've let a lot of these talented young players go away and go off. And Ruben Loftus-Cheek at Crystal Palace is maybe one that you look at recently and see how he's performing. There are guys kind of all over the league that were the Chelsea loanees that now have either had permanent moves or loaned out again. Yeah, they're performing for other teams in the Premier League that they could be using right now.
I was going to say Dominic Solanke went to Liverpool.
Yeah.
And it's expected to eventually. He hasn't contributed yet, but I think he will for sure.
He will. So, he's going
to
be good.
So that's going to be more painful, if, like you said, if these guys start to perform for other teams and they just let them go.
So the timing of this performance was crucial because Antonio Conte got a bit of respect and clout back where he can go upstairs and bitch a little bit and say, I want the money. Show me the money. But also, the performance wasn't good enough or great enough or complete enough to say, we've got everything we need. Boom. Topic one. So topic two moves us on perfectly to Spurs because the day at Wembley, if the shortcut to thinking is great day for Chelsea, a poor day for Spurs, but is it, you know? Of course, winning that game would have been important not only for their campaign, getting one over on a top four rival, a title rival, depending on where you fall in that debate. But most importantly, it would have assuaged the constant questions about can they perform at Wembley? Is this place, not only because of it being a new ground and it not being White Hart Lane, the place where they were absolutely dominant, went undefeated last season in the Premier League, 17 wins, 2 draws, 0 losses in 19 Premier League matches at White Hart Lane, 47 goals, only 9 conceded. So it wasn't as if home ground was comfortable. Home ground was dominant. Mm-hmm. No one came in there and got anything off of them. So the contrast to that, it doesn't matter if it's Wembley or any place, is going to be pretty stark. I mean, that's as dominant as you can get. That's as dominant as there is in the Premier League. So already there's questions, but then add on top of it how poor they've been at Wembley results-wise since they've got into the place. And, you know, last season it was one win, only one win in 6 matches. And this game would have at least been, okay, everyone, relax. We're not going to answer any of these questions about Wembley anymore. A win wouldn't have, I don't think a win wouldn't have convinced everyone that Wembley wasn't going to be an issue. And if that's true, then a loss can't mean that this is a place where they can't play. This is a place where they're going to struggle. Because they played really, really well. They did. And they were excellent. They created tons of chances. They forced so many amazing defensive plays out of Chelsea. They forced Chelsea to their absolute defensive maximum. And Chelsea came up with it. And that was more the storyline of the day, was how good Chelsea were rather than, you know, another poor Spurs display at Wembley. The fans were loud. We were in the studio and we kept just remarking to each other how loud it sounded, especially in those moments where they really had Chelsea back on their heels. We asked Arlo and Lee, right? It was Arlo and Lee who did the game. We asked them what they thought and they said it was. They took their headphones off a couple times to really get a true sense, mm-hmm. because when you get the effects in your ears, you can't really tell. But when you're on the gantry and you take your headphones off, sometimes you're shocked at how loud it actually is. And that's what they said.
Well, and before the match even started, and it probably wasn't even nearly as loud as it got during the match, when they were just trying to communicate lineups and information with you and Robbie and Rebecca in the studio, you could barely, they were having trouble hearing you guys. Normally, those lines of communication are pretty clear, but it was already that loud, you know, leading up to kickoff, where they were struggling just to hear, you know, a normal conversation, basically.
Yeah. Which means it was bumping. Yeah. It was bumping in there. So they're trying to Spursify the place, right? They're putting their seat covers in there. They're putting banners in there. They even have the cockerels, the famous cockerels from White Hart Lane that they took off the roof that they've got in the tunnel as they come out. I mean, they're doing everything they can, you know, kind of moving the furniture in to make them feel comfortable. Let me not sort of try and sugarcoat it or talk over that it's going to be difficult. Anytime you move into a new stadium, and I was talking to Lee Dixon about this when they left Highbury, anytime you make a move, it feels different. You know, you can't help but muscle memory is sort of it's linked to that sort of psychological trigger of when you walk into something that's comfortable, that reminds you of something, you get into that zone much easier. And, you know, a lot of soccer players are either superstitious or very habitual, where they have their same routine before the game. You know, I know guys that wouldn't change a thing, that same roads to the stadium, you know, same song they put on in their headphones, you know, same way they put their shoes on, you know, same part of the locker room that they warm up in before they go out, same part of the, you know, door frame that they touch before they leave. All of those tiny little things add up to giving you the psychological courage to say, I've done this before. You know what I mean? Like, that's how muscle memory works. Muscle memory is your body knows what it's supposed to do based on the repetition of having done it so many times. Your brain works the same way. I've walked down this tunnel so many times. I've driven, and this was my parking spot. All those things, trying to figure out your groove. Okay, where do I park now? Which one's my locker? That stuff definitely impacts you. I just think that Pochettino, one of the major focuses of him and all of his teams, is psychological, is mental preparation, is discipline. And I remember when Spurs fell apart at the end of last season. Remember we went over there, we saw them at the Britannia, they absolutely crushed Stoke, and we thought, here they go, they're going to march on to the title. And they collapsed, and they looked mentally weak. Mm-hmm. And everyone asked the question, is that going to happen next season? Are Spurs going to fall apart? Are they going to be mentally weak? And they weren't. They were just outpaced by a remarkable season that Chelsea had. So I just don't think that they're mentally weak or concentrating on or falling into this narrative that Wembley is going to be a place where they're not going to play well and they're not going to win games.
What do you make of the theory, though, that opposing teams are going to enjoy going to Wembley and they're going to look at it as this big occasion? I mean, even Conte said, you know, to see this atmosphere is great. It's a fantastic stadium. Also for the opponent, the type of stadium or atmosphere, it's so strong for us, you know, despite 70,000 Tottenham fans, our fans also tried to push us. So I understand what he's saying, but I guess my counter would be, couldn't you make that argument for teams that come to Old Trafford to play that they're going to say, oh, this is, we're playing to the theater of dreams, we're going to get amped up for this, or go to the Emirates and Anfield, you know? So is that different from playing at one of those, you know, historic grounds?
It's a really good question. I think it does. Here's the thing. For everything I just said about Spurs, it making them uncomfortable, you know, that will work in the advantage of teams that are traveling, because in the negative way, that's what White Hart Lane was for teams. They remember going there and getting pummeled. They remember going there and struggling. This is the locker I sat in last time we lost 3-0. This is the tunnel I walked through last time, you know, they were all over us. So Wembley won't have that for visiting teams, so they'll feel more comfortable in there. The only reason playing at Old Trafford and the excitement of that is different versus playing at Wembley, going, also talking about the fact many teams go to Old Trafford and get absolutely pummeled, is Wembley has been in the past and isn't now because of how often it's played in for, obviously, Spurs and the championship playoffs and now the semifinals of the FA Cup. Wembley used to be FA Cup final. It was the ultimate goal. Your dream as a kid was to get to Wembley. And so that carrot for players was the biggest ever. So to be able to go into that beautiful stadium now, even though it's full of Spurs fans and you're the away team, it's going to feel more comfortable to them, to visiting fans, than a lot of the major stadiums they go to. It will feel more comfortable than going to Old Trafford. It will feel more comfortable than going to Anfield. It will feel more comfortable than going to Stamford Bridge. It will maybe be commensurate with the Etihad and the Emirates. No, I mean, it will be, of all the big stadiums, of all the top teams, it will be the most comfortable place for teams to go and play. The only difference is they're going to be facing a team that I think is one of the best of the group I just mentioned. So I just think that Spurs are going to start to win some games here at Wembley. They're going to find their dominance. They're going to find their stride, and this story is going to go away. Now the problem is, who do they have next? Burnley.
Burnley, yep.
They lose to Burnley there, which is quite unthinkable. I mean, Burnley, as I said before,
just win at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, but and got their entire away win. from last season. They would be doubling their away wins from last season, as I said, if they win this game. Unthinkable. But if that happens, or if they just struggle, you know, if they struggle to break down Burnley,
a nil-nil draw or something,
then all of a sudden this thing compounds. You know, that's how these things work. Things start as stereotypes. Things start as narratives. Things start as as just sort of ridiculous storylines that people are trying to push until the story actually becomes reality a lot of times. I mean, the story is going to morph into being the real thing if they can't chase the story away. And they chase the story away by winning at Wembley in dominant fashion in the next few home games that they've got coming up. I mean, that's what they got to do. And, you know, you could pick out a couple of things in that game. Tactically, Pochettino did something I didn't love, where he wanted to crowd the midfield as well and bring in the flank play. It's a bigger field than White Hart Lane, so he wanted to get Trippier and he wanted to get Davis into the game in high positions. And he played Dyer. I'm going to run in the whistle, but I'm going to go a little over a tiny bit here. He played Dyer and Wanyama at the same time. Now, typically when he does that, he plays Dyer as one of the back three, but he played a back four in this game and used Dyer and Dembele, much like Bakayoko and Kante were used for Chelsea, to work inside channels and be an extra body in the midfield. And the way Chelsea were playing, so deep and so defensive, it was kind of redundant. It wasn't really needed. So I would have much rather have seen him drop Dyer into a back three if he wanted to play him, and added a more attacking-minded player into the side. I mean, I kind of would have liked to have seen maybe Son from the start or something like that. Nitpicky, because I thought they played really well, but they're just gonna have to win a game, because good performances aren't gonna be enough to chase away this whole, you know, voodoo stuff.
Well, it's interesting, you know, you kind of bring that up though, because I wonder still, just quickly to wrap Spurs up, does this show that they do need to make a move or two to just maybe improve their depth? And I know we think they do have a decent amount of depth, but you mentioned Trippier and Davies. You know, we think, okay, actually they're not bad. They can do the job, and they did do the job pretty well for the most part when Rose was injured and Walker came out of the squad. But in a game like that, does it look like they maybe might miss Walker and Rose? Who knows what's happening with Rose? His whole situation. But
I mean, could they do with two or three more players? Absolutely. I just don't think, out of all the teams that haven't spent a ton or haven't made a bunch of moves, Spurs kind of worry me the least because of the continuity of the last two seasons and the fact that over the last two seasons they have the most points and they've been the most dominant. But you're absolutely right. They need depth for Harry Kane. They need depth in the fullback position. And Lamella's coming back from an injury, but it's been such a weird one that he's been gone for so long.
A long time now, almost a full season, a full year, really.
So, another sort of Sissoko's not up for it, I don't think. So another winger attacking sort of forward, yeah. Let's move it on to Liverpool, another team struggling a bit at the beginning of this season. Not the prettiest 3 points at all against Crystal Palace. Crystal Palace coming off a terrible opening game, made some tactical adjustments in this one, and Koeman had his men set up, had them organized, and they performed really well. They were a tough defensive unit to break down, similar to his former teammate and compatriot Koeman, the way he set up Everton against Manchester City. It was just a difficult team for Liverpool to break down, Liverpool just, they were spinning their wheels a bit. And one area that is ultimately a positive but just didn't really pan out in this game is Daniel Sturridge is fit. He's available. He started this game. But moving Firmino out of the striker position centrally, it affected them. They just didn't really seem as dangerous, didn't seem as threatening. Now, it's understandable because they've had a lot of games to begin the season, dealing with Champions League, dealing with a really tight fixture list, so rotation has to be expected. But they were missing Firmino at striker, and they were missing Coutinho. They have, I guess, stuck by the stance. That's what Jurgen Klopp has done from the beginning. That's what FSG has done from the beginning. They're not selling this guy, and they've turned down a third and incredibly high bid. What was it, 118? We're getting close to
120.
Yeah, 120 million.
Pounds.
Pounds. I mean, it's remarkable the money they're turning down for this guy. But to be honest, go back to my preview pod, the first ad pod we did this season. I said I feel good about Liverpool if they can keep Coutinho. And what I said is if they believe that they can challenge for the title, if they truly believe that, forget the bookies, where the bookies have them out at as sixth best. I mean, that's where the bookies have them this season, or what fans think. If Liverpool, if that locker room, if they believe they can go win the title, maybe they pick up Van Dijk, maybe they pick up one other player, then you have to keep Coutinho. He's absolutely priceless. You can't sell him for any amount of money. And the fact that they're not going to sell him for what basically is any amount of money, I mean, the money getting thrown is insane. To me, it says, even though they're struggling at the beginning of the season, they believe in the side. And I've thrown this out a couple of times. Klopp took over Dortmund when they were 13th, I believe. It was 13th or 16th. Anyway, bottom half of the table, struggling. Then they finished 6th, 5th, first. Always moving the thing forward. Every season got a bit better. And then there was the big jump. There was the big jump in his third season. I think it could take a player signing. They do need to bring a little more depth. They do need to have backup in certain positions, or even a starting center back in Van Dijk. But keeping Coutinho is massive. And it looks like they're going to. I mean, it looks like that's it. That's done and dusted. Now, how many times have we said that and something pops up right before the window? But if it is done and dusted, then the focus has to move on to the defensive issues that they still have. And it's not about signing a guy, PJ. I mean, go get Van Dijk. I still think they have defensive issues. Mm-hmm. It's about set pieces, and through the run of play, sometimes they switch off. Sometimes it's just a momentary lapse of reason that costs them in moments that if they want to be title contenders, they can't be like that. They're not going to be title contenders if they defend like they've defended over the past four seasons. You know, any Liverpool, since the last time they won a title, a first division title, any Liverpool coming close season outside of that anomaly of Suarez and the Gerrard slip and that incredible, remarkable season under Brendan Rodgers, has been built on defensive solidity. You know, Rafa Benitez and some of these guys really making them a strong defensive unit. And Liverpool titles of yore, you know, of back in the day, that was always one of the first things you talked about those strong Liverpool teams. So they have to get that right. The other thing they have to get right is they're going to, again, like they did with Crystal Palace, come up against teams that bunker in, that sit back, that play tight and try to catch them on the counter. That's where they struggled last season. And it feels like that's where they're struggling again. I think with Salah, they have something a bit unique and different. Pace, crafty, comes in off the left. I mean, him and Mane in the same game with maybe a Coutinho behind them and a Lallana. And a Firmino. Yeah. I mean, that breaks a team down eventually. I mean, that's lockpicking right there. But they have to get better at that. I mean, because if they don't improve both of those a little bit, if they just get better defensively, they may still struggle to break down those teams. Now, granted, they won't get caught on the counter like they do in those games, but those are draws that they can't afford. If they fix the attacking side of things and they go and break down these teams, they're still going to get caught on the counter in those games from time to time. So I think that it's not big, major overhauls. It's literally just 5%. Get 5 to 10% better defensively, 5 to 10% better at breaking down teams, which I think they have with the acquisitions and keeping Coutinho. And they're there. I honestly think they're in a title race if they do that.
Well, they did make some slight tweaks to the lineup against Crystal Palace, and part of that might be because of the Champions League fixtures you mentioned. They've got a lot coming up. He's probably working some rotation in, but brought Ragnar Klavan in, Andy Robertson.
Who was excellent.
And I was going to say, his service from the left flank was great all game, and also defending. And then also James Milner back in midfield, because he doesn't – if Robertson can play left back, and we'll see what's going to happen with Moreno, if he can be relied on to play there too. But, you know, they have two left backs that are not named James Milner. If he can play in that midfield role, which is what he was brought there to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do those little tweaks, you said just all they need is 5-10% little change. Are little tweaks like that maybe the ones players that they already have in the squad? Could that also just work going forward?
Totally. Little tweaks, the 5-10% could be now all of a sudden they have Milner as an option in a crowded fixture list and as depth. You know, in terms of Henderson's foot always gives them a problem, Emre Can and Milner and Wijnaldum, you've got a lot that can sort of be tweaked and moved around to fill holes or protect you against injuries. Robertson makes them as good as Milner was last year, and he was excellent. Mm-hmm. Service from the left wasn't great because Milner was constantly cutting in on his right foot and creating trouble and making, you know, making incisive plays, but they are more dangerous with the left-footed Robertson, and we saw it in the game. The service into the box was excellent, and they'll start to read that and start to get more familiar with that. Salah was another one that I mentioned, who is an acquisition, but that frees up Mane to float around a bit more now that you have Salah, who likes to play off the right, where we would see Mane more often than not. So I do think that the other one, to go with your point, the 5 to 10% can come out of Sturridge. I mean, Sturridge is world class when he stays fit.
So you think he has a role to play this
season? I do.
So.
I think he does. I mean, he's just so good. If he can, you know, like Olivier Giroud, for instance. Olivier Giroud is okay with being a substitute. He comes on. He gets the business done. He likes being there. He had the option to leave. There were a couple clubs that are in for him. But he said, I want to stay. I want to be a part of this. If Sturridge truly believes that and can stay fit, I mean, that's an amazing option for them to have. It's just the problem is, and why I've said they should sell him in the past, is he just never can stay fit.
If he does stay fit, though, do you think he'll be content with being an occasional starter, being more of a super sub when they need him in Champions League games or Premier League?
That's
matches?
The question. I don't think so. I don't think so.
This guy was, arguably, you know, 3 years ago when Liverpool almost made that run. Well, the player
of the best.
Season.
Yeah,
almost,
totally.
From his teammate Suarez. But.
I mean, that was the SASAS. That was the Sterling Suarez Sturridge that was absolutely delightful and just irresistible. I don't think he will be. I don't think he can stay fit. I don't think he's okay with a spot on the bench. If I'm wrong on both of those things, he becomes the 5 to 10% by himself, for sure. So, I mean, that's big for them. Now, the window's almost shut. The whistle's coming up for Jurgen Klopp and all the other coaches where they can finally breathe easy and get back to things. And Champions League tomorrow, Liverpool, right? He said that Philip Coutinho is now sick. So it was the back injury. Now he's sick. They just all these managers are desperate for the window to close. And they're also, which is a conversation for another day, desperate for the window to close before the first kick of the season. And they're discussing that. And supposedly there's going to be a vote on it. So we'll see where that goes. But
I just want to finish up real quick, kind of a big picture with Coutinho, assuming they can hold on to him, which it looks like they right now that they're going to. Mm-hmm. Is it more about keeping him specifically or Liverpool in general making a statement that they're not no longer a selling club, and if they want to be considered one of Europe's elite clubs again, they're not going to sell their best players, especially to other top European clubs like Barcelona? Is it more of a not necessarily about Coutinho specifically, but in general saying, no, this is where we're going to make our change or our pivot, where we are now a top European club again, mm-hmm. and we're gonna buy the top players and keep our top players. Is
absolutely.
It more about that and not necessarily
absolutely
about-
there's two things. One is it makes that statement, and if they were to win a title, I argue there's no club in the world that would benefit more from winning their domestic title than Liverpool. I mean, because of their history, because of the frustration of being so dominant and being the second most successful club in England, but being so far away from the title since then, it would be remarkable. I mean, it would wake a beast in that club, a sleeping beast. They are a giant of a club. They're loved all over the world, but they're just not treated like champions because they haven't been in so long. So let me just, you know, I'll go a little extra time here because it kind of moves me on to Arsenal as well. Now it's official. Now I've definitely blown through it.
Liverpool's next opponent, by the way.
So Liverpool's next opponent is Arsenal, and it makes me think of Alexis. So What a mess Arsenal are in, that they have a number of players in their last year of their contract. Alexis being obviously the most high profile and the most productive and the one they want to keep. They are in this awful situation where if they don't sell him, he's going to leave for free. They're going to lose out on, I mean, in the market right now, call it anywhere from 50 to 70 million pounds, I mean, for this guy, right? I mean, that,
if not more.
Yeah. So, I mean, this guy's going to go for huge money if you sell him. Him being at the end of his contract kind of brings his value down
That's
a bit
true.
Because most people will just say, well, we'll just wait.
Yeah, because they know that Arsenal's sort of in
they'll
a
take a crack
position.
At him, and they'll offer him ridiculous wages in the summer because they don't have to pay the big transfer fee. Although Manchester City is saying, we'll buy you now, and we'll pay you 400,000 pounds a week. That's another story. But if Arsenal sell him, what does it say? It's just another player, another star, right when they're close to building something special that they sell to bring money in.
And their best player.
Yeah. and go down the list of all the players that have left to go win titles. You know, Cesc Fabregas, Samir Nasri. I mean, it's just they can't do that again. Yeah. They can't sell another star, even if it makes no financial sense. Which is ironic because Arsene Wenger is saying, I want to keep him, and whatever. Like, if he leaves and we lose money, like, that's the risk I'm willing to take. And most Arsenal fans are upset by that, which is so funny because you're also the same Arsenal fans that were upset when Arsene Wenger was fiscally responsible and wouldn't spend enormous sums of money because he was worried about the debt they had about moving into the Emirates Stadium. So Arsene Wenger finally has moved away from this long-term, fiscally responsible, very, very financially astute and balance sheet-oriented manager, right? He's finally moved away from that, and he said, I don't care if we're going to lose money on this guy. This guy can help us this season, and who knows? Maybe we can go win the title. I love that from Arsene Wenger. That's great. He's finally switched away from the, you know what, sell him for 70, and I can go make some great value buys and get two or three young players that people haven't heard of or they haven't seen yet, and I can buy them for 5 or 10 and build them up, and I'll sell them one day for 100. You know, finally he's saying, I think because he sees the light at the end of the tunnel. He's got 2 years left on his contract. I honestly believe for the first time he sees the end. He knows it's approaching. After the Stoke game, I mean, this is a bit ridiculous, but Wenger out was trending on Twitter, which is a bit ridiculous.
But not surprising.
But not surprising. But here's the problem. He's put himself in a terrible situation because if they keep him, you know what's going to happen in January and February? January comes around, a time where they traditionally struggle in the league, and all of a sudden a pre-contract announcement, and we hear what club abroad, because he can't do a pre-contract in England, what club, you know, Alexis is moving to play for next year. How will that feel in the Arsenal locker room when Alexis has already signed up with Bayern Munich, with PSG, and you're playing the rest of the season with him? As an Arsenal fan, as a player in the locker room, that can't be good. So that's the other thing about this, that if there was a contract guy, and there is in many clubs, you know, there is a guy that deals with the business, or a girl like at Chelsea. I mean, there is a contract player acquisition executive that handles all of this. If that person let the amount of players at Arsenal getting to the end of their contracts, playing with 1 year left on their contracts, especially high-profile players, that person would be fired. No one would stay in a job if they had the list of players that Arsenal has with their contracts expiring at the end of the year. I mean, we're talking about a quarter of a billion pounds of talent that could walk out the door for free at the end of the season. How bad is that? And you know who's responsible for that? Arsene Wenger. That's Arsene Wenger doing that. So they've gotten away from that. They've kind of clawed back some of his power in that area. But it just further illustrates that the Wenger era, they have to move on from it. I mean, and I honestly think they've waited too long, because what happens if they have a terrible season, finish outside the top four this year, and lose all those players, and Arsene Wenger in the last year of his contract is playing in the Europa League, is schlepping the team off to God knows where, and the team's got to look around and see that five of their stars from last season are gone, playing for other clubs in the Champions League, most of them. So that was my Arsenal rant that I didn't plan to get on, but the player movement thing is crazy. We may see a big... I predict we see a big, big move right before the end of the window. Okay. And who knows who it's going to be, but it's going to be someone. And Arsenal fans are I don't even know where they stand. Are they hoping that it's Alexis, or they're hoping it's not? I don't even know. But if it is Alexis, it can't be to Manchester City, because that Wenger out would be trending number one. We're out. PJ's out. I'm out. The Tad Pod's out. Thanks again for listening, Tad Podders. Don't forget to send those reviews, your favorite soccer moment, the one that made your hair stand up. And also, don't forget, stand your feet.